Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and ever since Iran's 2009 Twitter revolution and Egypt's 2011 Tahrir Square protests spurred by Facebook and Twitter, the promise that social media could get around repressive authoritarian regimes has excited activists. Emily Parker is here now to talk about her new book, Now I Know Who My Comrades Are, Voices from the Internet Underground, in which she draws on her past experience as a journalist and a member of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's policy planning staff. Now she's a digital diplomacy advisor. I never heard that job title before. You'll have to explain to me what that is. And senior fellow at the New America Foundation to tell the story primarily of activists in three countries, China, Cuba, and Russia, and what each can show us about the strengths and weaknesses of web-based activism. Welcome to WNYC, Emily Parker.
Thank you so much, Brian. I'm happy to be here.
And what is a digital diplomacy advisor? What do you do for a living?
So I'm a senior fellow and digital diplomacy advisor, which means I advise the New America Foundation about ways to use technology to advance foreign policy goals.
And you open the book with the fact that Facebook and Twitter were important tools in Egypt. But the organizing had certainly begun long before the famous We Are All Khalid Said page went up on Facebook, right?
That's correct, yes. So I think that there has been a lot of emphasis on the role of social media in organizing the Egyptian revolution, particularly with emphasis on January 25th. But the point that I make in the book is that those online networks had been forming for years. And most important, in Egypt, ordinary citizens online were overcoming the fear, isolation, and apathy that keep authoritarian regimes in power.
So did what happened in Egypt wake up pro-democracy activists and repressive regimes to the power of the internet?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question of that. And we've seen the repercussions all over the world. For example, I think China was deeply spooked by the Arab Spring, and they were incredibly nervous about what they called a Jasmine Revolution. And we saw an intense crackdown of any kind of dissident activity following the Egyptian Revolution.
So listeners, anybody with ties to any country want to weigh in on this? Or if you're just interested in the issue, are you following protests anywhere in the world via social media and blogs? Call and recommend your favorite sources for information that gets beyond the censors in countries that do a lot of censoring, or anything else. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And should we establish that the repressive regimes are now using social media as much as the activists, and that there's a lot of danger there? So, for example, I think in Iran, people who were, you know, in the democracy movement may have been thinking that they were acting with more impunity than they were, or more invisibility to the government. But I've read that they then went and tracked down people based on their Twitter handles and things like that. And there were consequences to be paid.
Absolutely. I definitely would never make the argument that the states are not effectively using the internet to crack down on dissidents. The internet is absolutely a double-edged sword. So while you have citizens using the internet to spread information, to gather, to start online petitions, at the same time, you also have the government using online tools to surveil citizens and to arrest bloggers and to intimidate people online. But my book is largely about the psychological impact of the internet in authoritarian states. And what's most important in countries like China and Cuba and Russia is that critics of the government who once believed that they were completely isolated in their dissent go online and they find hundreds, thousands, maybe even millions of like-minded individuals, and they know that they are no longer alone. And it's very hard for the state to erase that with censorship.
And you organize your book around the main barriers to activists under authoritarian governments: isolation as a barrier in China, fear as a barrier in Cuba, apathy as a barrier in Russia.
Yes.
And it's Chinese activist Michael Anti who gave you your title, your book title, Now I Know Who My Comrades Are. Where did that come from?
So, just to be clear, you know, all three of these countries are afflicted by isolation, fear, and apathy, but I kind of highlight one in each case. So in China's case, we tend to talk about the internet in terms of freedom of speech and freedom of information. But it's important to remember that the Chinese government is most worried about freedom of assembly. They are not so concerned about what you say online, but how you use online tools to organize collective action. So the title of my book comes from a conversation that I had in Beijing in 2004 with an internet dissident named Michael Anti. And this is someone who grew up believing firmly in the Communist Party of China. He believed everything he saw on television and everything that he read in the newspapers. And it wasn't until 1999, 10 years after the Tiananmen crackdown, that he was in a hotel room and he went online and he discovered what had really happened that year. And he discovered basically that the Chinese army had fired on its own people. And this was a world-changing realization for him. And he cried all night and his entire universe was turned upside down. And I think there was a time in China when somebody would have a realization like this and they would be completely alone. He didn't really trust his friends to talk about it. He didn't want to talk about it with his parents. But online, he found other people that shared that same sense of disillusionment. So when I asked Michael Anti, why does the internet matter in China? You know, they're censoring it heavily. There's surveillance. There's firewalls. Why does the internet matter? And he said, because now I know who my comrades are.
Hmm. And let's take a phone call, China related, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Corinne in Ridgewood, you're on WNYC. Hello, Corinne.
Hi, thanks, Brian. Love the show.
Thank you.
I lived in China for 6 years, just recently moved back, speak Chinese, have a lot of Chinese friends. My question for your guest is regarding Tiananmen Square and the Tiananmen Massacre, how much do people really know? Because when I would talk to ordinary people, women my age, you know, late 20s, early 30s, some of them wouldn't even know what happened. They'd kind of look at me like with blank stares, and one good friend in particular would say, you know, I've seen accounts of what happened, but they've all been written by foreigners. And it would only really be if I could see an account written by a native Chinese, by a fellow Chinese, that I would actually believe what happened. So how much do you think this is just sort of a small group of elites in China or people who are very proactive and political? And how much is actually touching sort of regular people in the cities, people that, you know, are busy with their lives and are doing better because people are getting richer and richer in China? Thank you.
Thank you. Great question.
Thank you. So that's absolutely true. I think it's shocking that there are still young Chinese who probably do not have a very clear understanding of what happened in 1989. That definitely persists. And my book actually looks at the people, the Chinese people whose lives have been transformed by this sense of deception. So Michael Anti is one example. It's this feeling that you grow up thinking there's one side of the story. You kind of believe the Communist Party narrative, which is that these were counter-revolutionary elements who were starting violence in the streets. And then via the internet, you discover an alternative reality. And I think that has actually turned some people into dissidents. It wasn't so much anger at what happened in 1989. It's a sense of being deceived by a government that you truly believed in. So I have seen, it's not all foreign news reports. For example, sometimes there will be a Tiananmen-related piece of news that is blocked in China, and you will see people online saying, wait, why did my TV just go blank, or why is this website blocked? And then you will actually see conversations online between different generations. I've seen this happen. I've seen a young person in China say, I only have a fuzzy impression of what happened in 1989. Can somebody older please explain it to me? And then you'll see somebody older post a link or post an explanation. And yes, those things will be censored and they'll be blocked eventually, but the information still gets through. And that's kind of the power of information sharing in China.
And as such, with Tiananmen as backdrop, would it be accurate to say it's not so much freedom of speech that's the big issue in China, rather freedom of assembly?
Absolutely, 100%. I think that after 1989, the Communist Party said, this will never happen again. We are not going to let this happen again. And since then, they have clamped down on any kind of physical assembly by, you know, potential critics. They've clamped down on this with a vengeance. And we saw this in 1999, for example, with Falun Gong, a religious group. And Falun Gong just came to Beijing and all they did was assemble. They didn't do anything. They just assembled in Beijing. But they caught the government off guard. And after that, Beijing went after them fiercely. And so now, I mean, in China, if you're a group, even a small group that the government distrusts, it's very difficult to assemble physically. That's why the internet is such a monumental phenomenon, because it's the one place where you can find people like you.
Danny in Cornwall, you're on WNYC. Hello, Danny.
First off, thanks for taking my call. Hey, Grandma from Brooklyn. Hey, I'm kind of thinking that, considering Edward Snowden has showed us all that we're under surveillance, I don't think there's a lot of freedom in the internet. And number two, when you're talking about Egypt, they had a revolution. Now they're sort of back in the same position, maybe even worse. So I'd like you guys to maybe talk about that.
Well, that's I'm sure that may be a question that goes beyond the scope of your studies. But anything you would say to him? I think he's just skeptical in general of the power of these online movements to bring about actual change as opposed to talk about actual change. What would you say?
Well, so yes, just to briefly address the Snowden question, I mean, the one thing that the whole Snowden revelation shows is that even the United States cannot completely control information. I mean, this information has gotten out. And so, you know, the United States has not been able to completely control the narrative about how it conducts its activities. So I think that my book does not focus on the United States specifically. I'm looking at censorship and surveillance in, you know, three different countries. And you're right, the internet is not free. It's not a free place. And the United States is struggling with this as well. I don't think that the United States is perfect in this area. As for Egypt, you're also absolutely right about that. And I try to make that point very clearly in my book. You have to be careful what you wish for. And a lot of people say, well, social media, if it's not causing revolution, it's not doing anything at all. And my book is not saying that social media should cause revolutions. Sometimes social media and the internet can transform a country without causing a revolution. So in Egypt's case, social media was extremely useful in bringing down the government because it was a leaderless revolution. And that meant that it was very difficult for authorities to find one leader and chop off his head. It was all over the place. The downside of a leaderless revolution is that there are no leaders. So once the revolution succeeds, you can have a lot of chaos. And that's what we're seeing in Egypt. And frankly, that's what we would see in a lot of parts of the world where a revolution was organized in this way.
Emily Parker, author of Now I Know Who My Comrades Are, Voices from the Internet Underground. And one more thought about the United States from our comments page. Jenna on the Upper East Side writes, so we've seen what social media can do in countries where people are willing to physically organize. But here in the U.S., it doesn't work. With Occupy and SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, we got a lot of talk and little physical effort. The Iraq War saw larger protests, meaning that was before this current social media era. Do you think she has a point? And even for international purposes, do you think people think they're doing something when they're active online, when really they're not going to bring about change unless they get physically involved, as in Tahrir Square?
Yeah, well, there is this question of, is this opposition only virtual? Are these protests only virtual? And the argument that I make in the book is that the internet just reflects the reality on the ground. So if there is a real spark, and if there is a need for offline protest, that protest will happen. So if you look at Egypt, for example, in Egypt, for years leading up to the revolution, there were all kinds of online protests. And people here were very dismissive about those protests. They said, you know, online dissent will never go into the streets because that spark hadn't been lit. And then when the government fell in Tunisia, Egyptians suddenly realized that they had a shot and that maybe revolution would work in Egypt as well. And that was the trigger that caused online dissent to go offline. So sometimes what seems to be only virtual can become offline in what seems like the blink of an eye.
About Russia, in your book, you focus on apathy. And there is news today that the activist you focus on there, Alexei Navalny, is under house arrest and on orders to stop using the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Are you following his work?
Yes, absolutely. So Navalny plays a very big role in my book. Navalny is a fascinating person for many reasons, but he's someone whose current existence in many ways was created by the internet. So Navalny when I started looking at Navalny a few years ago and talking to him, and he wasn't really known so much outside of Russia. He wasn't nearly as famous as he is today. And Navalny, you know, he's basically been barred from Russian television, which is where most Russians get their news. And he was effectively marginalized by the state and by the state media. So he created an entirely alternative base of support via the internet, via his blog, and now has risen to become the most prominent opposition figure since the fall of the Soviet Union. It's really quite impressive. And so what's noticeable about his house arrest is that he's been barred from using the internet. And just a few years ago in Russia, and that's why I talk about apathy, you know, Russia has a much freer internet than China, for example. But there was what one journalist said to me in Russia. She said, you can find anything online in Russia. The problem is people don't search for it. The internet was not a significant threat in Russia because of apathy, because people just thought, what is the point? We can organize a protest online. We can organize a protest offline, but nothing is going to change in this country. And I think that's slowly starting to change. And I think the fact that the authorities now see the internet as a real threat is great testament to its power.
Mandeep in Hackensack, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Nice to talk to you again. Basically, what I think, I'm 24, and I think my generation has a real problem with carry through. We can start a protest, we can start a lot of noise. So it's like almost like an ADD, that protest becomes a fad. We had Occupy Wall Street, which completely died out. I honestly think that my generation is not ready to take up leadership. They're ready to make noise, but they're not really there to go from protest like in Egypt. You know, protests happen and the face changes. But it's the same somebody who comes in who's the same as the last person.
Mandeep, thank you very much. I don't know if we can generalize to country after country. Is that something that rings true to you in general or for some places but not others?
Well, I think it's a real warning. And I think there's something that the world needs to be very careful about. And I think Egypt sent out a real warning to opposition movements throughout the world, because you're right. There is, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, use social media to get people out on the streets and get people excited. But it's a totally different thing to sustain the momentum of that protest movement and to actually build something new. And one thing that I find somewhat heartening is that in Russia, for example, some of the opposition activists are looking at Egypt and they're drawing that lesson and they're trying to be more organized. You know, for example, Russian activists had an online election for the opposition in order to develop some sort of hierarchy within the opposition and to make it more organized. You know, there were flaws to this process, but I think it's a step in the right direction. They looked at Egypt and they look at other movements around the world and they say, we need to be more organized. We need to make this something that can last. It can't just be all about the energy and the excitement about getting people onto the streets.
Since you write primarily about China and Cuba and Russia in this book, do you think the nature of fear is different in each of those three countries?
Absolutely. I do think the nature of fear is different in those three countries. I think there's fear in all three of those countries, for sure, to varying degrees. I focus on Cuba the most in terms of fear, just because in my experience, Cuba, there was a sense of paranoia that I didn't feel as strongly in the other countries. Cuba has had a long tradition, I guess, of citizen informers. And so one of the things that I heard over and over again in Cuba is you never know who is who. It means that an informer could be sitting next to you at a cafe. It could be your neighbor. It could be someone in your school. And that kind of paranoia spread through all levels of society. I heard this from people who are not dissidents. And the reason why this fear is important is because it helps keep the Cuban government in control, because people are, if you don't trust your neighbors, you're not going to band with your neighbors in protest. If you don't trust the people around you, you're not going to speak out. So fear is a really paralyzing emotion. And one thing I discovered in Cuba is that the bloggers that I met there were the few individuals that had overcome this fear, because they went online and they actually said what they really thought. They found their voices. And these were voices that had been hidden their whole lives, but they overcame that online.
That's so fascinating. Let me tack on one thing before you go, because I see that you wrote an essay for the New York Times Book Review a couple of years ago on the impact of books on policy in Washington. As somebody who just completed a book on policy, do you think books matter?
I do think books matter. So in that essay, I argue, because I am a writer who spent some time in government and learned a little bit about how writing penetrates into government. And one thing I learned is that books do matter in government, but government officials don't necessarily read the whole book. So they, you know, government officials don't have a lot of time to read, but the ideas in the book can still get through. Usually they get through in more of a bite-sized form. So they'll get through in the form of book reviews or in articles about the book or in interviews with the author. So ideas can get into government even if people are not reading entire books.
So first the government official looks themselves up in the index,
mm-hmm.
and after that they listen to their favorite talk show.
Exactly.
Emily Parker, her new book, Now I Know Who My Comrades Are, Voices from the Internet Underground. So fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, it's the Data Geek's Guide to Winning a Best Picture Oscar. Stay with us.